Hello, my friends. Hello, my life warriors, wherever you are in the world. I hope you're having a good day. Welcome to the Day In, Day Out podcast. This is episode number 56, where I had the joy and the pleasure of having Maurice Nicholson on the podcast today. He is a consultant, got to the partner level, and we're basically talking about his journey as a consultant as well as other subjects as well, other topics. But sit back, enjoy this podcast. He is a very outstanding fella. And please subscribe. Have a good day now. Peace. Hello, my friends. Hello, my life warriors, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to the Day In, Day Out podcast. This is episode 56 with... Excuse me, my voice is going because last night it was Liverpool winning the Premier League for the first time. I know I should not be really saying this or putting it out there, but nevertheless, good times, ahoy. Today's guest is Maurice Nicholson. He is a partner or former partner at Kentar Consulting. Thank you for coming on today, sir. How are you?
Thank you for having me. Great. So I'm in the midst of my first cup of coffee. I guess you're getting ready for your first beer to celebrate. But doing well. In the midst of the world being on fire, I'm doing very well.
Excellent. Yes. The reason why I got in contact with you, there was a post called Black and Brilliant, which I saw, which I was very privileged to be put on as an additional, same thing with yourself. And I thought, let me reach out to you because you are a person who had, like, from looking at your LinkedIn profile, you have come a very long way from your time at being at the Bronx School of Science all the way up until becoming a consultant today. I was hoping you could go through some of the stages of your journey.
Yeah, no, it's actually probably starts even before then, right? And it probably goes back. Well, I should probably tell a little bit back about how my family came into America. We're from Jamaica, both my mother and my dad, born in Jamaica. My mother, my grandmother was a member of parliament in Jamaica in the 60s, right after independence. But she was in the Conservative Party. And then the political ties started to change and she started thinking about opportunities, sent her daughters to be educated in the States with my dad, out of wedlock birth, here I come. So I spent a lot of my early childhood in what you guys call council housing, right? We call it projects, right? So, but it did well in school, in my academics, and I was blessed, you know, as you get to this age, you start reflecting back on all these things. Mm. And I was blessed. I had a teacher in the sixth grade say, you know what, Maurice, you're really, really smart. And she started exposing me to these different academic programs for talented kids. And one of the things she told me was, and I'll never forget this, God helps those who help themselves. Mm. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
And so you wonder where I'm going with this. So I never forgot that. And more importantly, I started taking exams into specialized junior high schools. And then I ended up at Bronx High School of Science, which is probably like one of the top five high schools in America. At that time, lots of Caribbean kids there who were also immigrants. So a lot of kids from Asia. Southeast Asia, Indian subcontinent, a lot of immigrant white kids. That's where all these smart kids who couldn't afford private school ended up going. And it was there I sort of found myself in a way and got confidence and started to believe in my own capabilities and started to see a world bigger than from where I came, right? It's not enough to have the talent, but you actually have to see the possibilities and understand that something can be for you. And so it's through that experience with my sixth grade teacher and that experience that said, hey man, there's a much bigger world out there and you have a right to claim a big piece of it, despite what some might show you and some of the media might portray. I started to believe, I'm like, that person's no better than me, that person's no better than me, that fact, right? I'm better than them,
yeah,
you know, intellectually, and I should, you know, have the right to go there. So it's with that, I figured out, so my grades, so while I tested, well, my grades are just okay. It's like, okay, I need to figure out something else to help me get into university. Quickest sport I could pick up is track. So, you know, run hard, turn left, run hard, turn left, right? And so I got a track scholarship, or a partial track scholarship, partial academic scholarship into Boston University, did well there, both athletically and more importantly, academically. Mm. Had a professor, you know, and this is a really important thing, right? You know, and a lot of things that us as Black people, as people of the African diaspora don't oftentimes have, is an advocate, somebody who sees the potential in you. And as I talk about, you know, my career and as I reflect upon it, there are moments where I was able to move forward, not just because I worked hard or whatever, but I also had an advocate to sort of say, you know, here's something that you could pursue. I'm going to expend my personal capital, if you will, to connect you into my social circles, right? And that's one of the things that we talk about in the Black and Brilliant subgroup, is how do we get more people spending capital, their social capital, to advocate on behalf of other Black people to help them move forward. So this has been a theme, not as much as I would like, and we need to increase that, but in the key moments, I had the ability, and then somebody recognized that ability, and somebody got behind me. So that's how I got from Brock Science to Boston University. And then from Boston University, I got my first job. After I did well in this one professor's class in operations management, he was doing some consulting on the side for a company in the Midwest of America, like your Midlands equivalent. And he put in a good word for me. I got a job out there, a place called Kansas, Wichita, Kansas. I can tell you all sorts of cultural, funny cultural situations, but, you know, being a Black man of Caribbean descent in the middle of America, you know, you sort of like, it's just overwhelmed. You stand out, right? And you realize, like, you know, the America that you were living in on the coast is very different than America in the middle. But, you know, it made me better. Had a great stint. It was an aircraft company called Beach Aircraft. We're making planes. Great stint. Always knew I was going to leave. And then the same person that advocated for me and got me that job had done his doctorate in business at the Harvard Business School. So when it came time for me to apply, I could turn back to him and he wrote me a recommendation. And I got in. And so that's my... a little bit of my academic background, too.
Yeah.
Because, I'll pause there.
Yeah, no, because this is the thing. Like, getting into a top five school in the United States, that is like a mission on itself. And it's quite fortunate that you had someone in your corner to sort of like, oh, do this, do that.
Yeah.
And then basically from there, going to Boston University, like doing track. What were you running in track, by the way?
Yeah, man, I was a 400 meter guy. I was everything from 100 to 400.
Yeah.
I still feel like I got unfinished business with the sport at this late stage of my life. you know, I was not bad. I was not bad. I never really lived up to the full potential. That was my 400 meters.
Yeah, no, but like doing that to get into university to do business administration, and then finding someone who was an advocate for you to help like guide you along the way. Like with regards to mention the Black and Brilliant, excuse me. Do you find the people who advocated for you were very important in putting some key foundation stones in your sort of future career path?
I think they were. They were at least really important in terms of sort of giving you some guidance, right? Now there are things that I didn't get, right? You know, again, stepping back to who my parents were, right? Immigrants to the country, Mom didn't, I mean, she didn't finish high school until late, and then she went to college, like, when I was an adult, right? And so giving me guidance, teaching me social etiquette in the business world just wasn't there. Mm-hmm. Same for my dad, right? So you have to at least find ways to observe and learn. Mm-hmm. Again, place where you can observe and learn. If you're a quick study, you could pick it up. The sad reality is, you know, there's probably a lot of stuff I didn't learn because I didn't have enough of that, right? But I got a door open, and I made the best with what was in front of me, which is great. But yeah, it's I would say, you know, when I look at Black folks writ large, America, South America, the European continent, I mean, I think that's an area where we lack. And if I think about things that I wanted to give back, it's just sort of, you know, helping people have the ability to navigate these worlds. Some guidance, some advice at key moments, how to navigate politics, you know, the corporate politics and all of that stuff.
I would say when it comes to sort of corporate politics, many of us, I think, when you're sort of thrown in there, like young-eyed, bushy-tailed, like, as they say, full of piss and vinegar, it's a case of, like, no one actually tells you what that sort of etiquette is, what the sort of ups and downs and how to not so much play the game, but to basically help put you yourself in the best light. You know?
Yeah, no, it's interesting, right? You know, it's one thing that you, so in all social interactions, there's tension and there's aggression, right? And there's confrontation. But if you grow up in council housing or projects, right? Like where you get hit with that confrontation, there's an adrenaline rush that sort of releases your fight or flight mechanism. And that mechanism incense certain behaviors in that moment, right? Yeah. You know, it's like, look, man, somebody come to test you, you immediately get up and you really, but in the corporate world, you have to really tamp down that and you have to be really measured on how you respond and how you artfully deal with people through words, through diplomacy, versus hard standing your ground, letting them know whether you're not going to stand for something, right? Like, there's a way to navigate these things with delicacy and play that game, build allies, which I learned over the years, but, you know, my early days in corporate America, man. Man, stories. My son will be better for it, right? He'll learn from me. Absolutely. And, you know, and others will learn from me, I hope.
Yeah, no, I'm sure they will, because, like, yeah, I think you've got the focus and your head screwed on tightly enough to, like, go, okay, this is where your dad did this. Don't do that. Do this instead. It'll help you out in the long run. But to sort of, like, go from the East Coast, look, I've been to America and I've been on the East Coast of the United States, first in Virginia, where I worked in a summer camp, a religious camp, and then basically the rest of my time I was in upstate New York with the Fresh Air Fund. I don't know if you know those guys.
Oh yeah, well aware.
Yeah, so like I was in I was in Camp Hayden Marks up in Fishkill. I don't know if you
know. I know Fishkill. Yeah, not too far from here. Yeah.
So basically, I got a glimpse of how kids sort of interacted with themselves from like different parts of New York, just because they were just chucked together, welcome to camp, and away they go. So doing that jump from the East Coast to the like Midwest, is it?
Yeah, it is.
What were the sort of things you picked up on? What were the challenges you found there?
Oof. I mean, it's, you know, in this moment, I think America, the veil of America is being peeled back, right? Right. So, you know, America is sort of like South Africa with a better economy and a much better marketing program.
Okay, yes.
Yeah. So when I got to Wichita, so what I didn't know was that this company had been sued by the federal government for its lack of minority participation in the leadership roles.
Okay.
So I walked into an environment that was highly racially charged. And I had no idea because I was from outside the community. And in retrospect, they probably picked me for the senior management training program because I was an outsider and they would hope I would be there for a couple of years and leave, right? This is how deep some of that, you know, resistance to change on the racial front is in America. So the one thing I had to get used to, look, we've got racism everywhere. Right? To say there's no racism in New York is a crock. But the sort of calculated, really, how can we keep folks down? I was just never, just, this was just, I mean, at least you had white people in New York that liked Public Enemy, right? They might not like black people, they like some rap music, they like some, you know, whatever. But these folks were just a total, and I'm generalizing, some people I was exposed to in key positions were that way. And I was like, I'm 23 years old, I'm managing a department of 33 people. I had people tell me literally like, yeah, you know, when I was younger, you know, we were young, we were stupid, we were bored. You know, yeah, we used to go to Klan meetings.
Okay. Okay, wow.
Yeah. So there was that social, like, how do I navigate that world of people who, you know, even if they weren't racist, they sort of grew up in, they were breathing that air, they were drinking that water. And even though they might like me and whatever, they, you know, they still lived in, like, that contaminates everything, right? Mm-hmm. It's like washing your hands, but you're in the middle of a dust storm. Like, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, no, because this is the way, like, the way I see it. They put you, like, in a quite a tough position because, like, you're going to either have someone, like, going, he's a diversity hire and he doesn't know his job, or it's a case of, you're just making up the numbers. We're not going to take you seriously, regardless. Yeah. So it's
a
very.
And I'm fresh out of. Yeah. It's a very. And I'm fresh out of college, right? So not knowing the job is part of my existence. Oh. I gotta come in. Right, I gotta come in and learn because you know nobody's gonna teach you how to do the specific job you're hired for, right? So you gotta apprentice. Mm. You gotta build relationships with your more senior. Like, look. I'm working in a factory that's making aircraft and aircraft parts, right? I got to learn this from the senior folks, how to think about governing a department. And then from the junior people who are like literally bucking rivets, right? Like stapling things together. Like I got to learn all of this. And then at some point I got to have mastery enough where I can command the respect. Mm. And it was quite a dance. It is lucky that I am, you know, it's very interested in. So I had a passion. I learned, I worked hard. And I did find some people that really took me in, you know, and I still send them messages to this day.
Yeah.
I remember going to a country bar and just getting drunk and like literally falling off a chair and them carrying me out. But finding ways to bridge those cultural gaps, right? Because at the end of the day, we're all human. And as much as somebody might say, we don't like this or we don't like that one, once people see your humanity, in a vulnerable, and you show it in sort of like in a vulnerable way, people have no choice to sort of look past that and see you and connect with you. There will be people that see you, and then you will make a friend across a cultural boundary. And I think, you know, my life is richer for that experience. And I can tell, you know, though that work that I did at that time has absolutely nothing to do with the work that I do today, the cultural connections, the insights into people serve me incredibly well. It helps guide how I do market research, right? Because I realize there's a bunch of people in the middle of the country that you need to understand. They're not just like these other people, that like it's a unique culture. And I can speak to that authentically. So, you know, rich experience. I still go back to that community, you know, every few years to say hello to folks that took me in both black and white, like across the boundaries.
Yeah.
I think people just better serve, you know, I can imagine there's people in the city who don't understand people in Everton, right?
Yeah,
the hell those people, how could those people vote for X? Right, not to get into the politics, right? But until you experience that lived experience, you can't bring the insights into why they see the world that they do and then find a way to bridge the gap. And I think that's something that I pride myself on being able to do.
Yeah, I would imagine that like picking up those skills to bridge gaps must have helped you, like even though you're working in a completely different sector, it must have helped you to no end when coming into a new team, back in New York or wherever it took you in the future.
Yeah. So I, you know, coming out of graduate school, right? So I'm at Harvard. Again, I feel like I always carry this chip on my shoulder. Maybe one day I'll let go of it, like when I'm driving a Rolls Royce, right? But I always feel like, you know, I'm just a black kid from the projects who's smart, clever, who crafty, who's made it, and I'm next to these other more polished people.
Well, come on now. Look, this is the reason why the NBA exists. Look, if you got this, if you got the gumption, the intelligence, and then basically you've like worked your ass off out in the industry, the NBA is meant to be that next thing to help you get that next run up the ladder. And look, for you to get into Harvard's business school, come on now, that is down in
person. But then you're there with 800 other folks who got in, who are incredibly ambitious, incredibly hardworking, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, in many ways, some of them might've been more hardworking than me because they understood how challenging the game is. I've always been, in my group, one of the smartest. So I get to Harvard and I'm like, oh man, I got to ratchet up this game, right? You know, I'm working till 11, 1 o'clock every morning, preparing classwork. It's a real, real pressure cooker. And you know, your first year is sort of sorting out business, right? You know, which crew you're going to be. It's not, you're putting on a sorting hat, right? And figure out where you're going to be, where you fit in. You know, are you an alpha? Are you going to be prized and valued by the most prestigious hiring companies, the Goldman Sachs and the McKinsey's? And it's funny, in retrospect, I think I'd always had this, I got to prove that I'm smart thing. This is probably like an insecurity that I've always had.
Right.
So I went for the toughest job to get. And a company that did very little hiring of black people back then, which is a company called McKinsey & Company, management consultancy.
Yeah.
I remember all the folks who were going to the company career fairs that they would hold and the presentations. And I was always in the back, probably a little rough around the edges, and the more polished folks were up front schmoozing. I didn't have the schmooze game down. But you know, what was interesting, what was neat about those folks, it's like all that was nice, but if you couldn't deliver the smarts, you didn't get the job. And out of all the MBA hires, out of all the interviewing McKinsey did for the summer of 92, they only hired three African Americans, three black folks across the country, right? Two from Harvard, one from Stanford, and none from anywhere else. And I was one of those guys, right? But you're the beagle. You're the beagle chasing the car, and I caught the car. And I'm like, now what do I do with the car?
I've got this now. Where do I go with it?
Wow, man. I never saw this day of like getting the car, and I caught the car.
Yeah.
Great summer. They made me an offer to come back, which is great, right? Because it's a little extra bonus. When you work for them this summer, you come back, it does some extra change, which is great to help me pay for school. and learn quite a bit there. Had a decent run there. And then from there, I moved. This is in their Cleveland office, so it's not my home city. Got a little bit homesick. Figured I didn't want to be a consultant for the rest of my life, and moved back to to New York City to work for American Express. That's a whole big chapter of my career.
Yeah, no, because like this is the thing, like with regards to sort of like there's a certain mindset at McKinsey And because, mm-hmm. like, the reason why I say this, like, my lady, she did the MBA at Judd, mm-hmm. at Judd Business School in Cambridge.
Yeah.
And, like, basically, she was talking about the whole, like, a number of different people talking about the whole interview process. And, like, it was, you could be working in, say, let me think of a place. You could be working at EY, Ernest Young, or like PricewaterhouseCooper. They had a certain mindset, yeah. but McKinsey was like, we're McKinsey. It's kind of like Big Blue, IBM back yeah. in the day. And it was just yeah. like, yeah, if you didn't have an inkling of that mindset, they would not even give you the time of day. Like, thank you very much.
Yeah. Bye-bye. No, it's like, you know, a scientific thinking brought into business, incredible rigor and problem solving, incredible intellectual curiosity. It's probably there that I probably say, okay, I'm now working in a group of people where I am not the smartest. Clearly, you walk in, you're like, wow. And you know, I got to see some amazing things. I remember being at a conference for the energy practice, and the guys from Enron were presenting. And they started talking about their strategy and what they were promoting and where they were taking the company. I just remember sitting in the back of the room and like, okay, I'm not as clever as any of these other folks, but yeah, this does seem right. But maybe they know something that I don't know. I can talk to you ad nauseum about off-balance sheet transactions to pump up. The appearance of doing great revenues, but
if anyone's going to show you that, it's definitely going to be Enron.
but it was, look, the time I did at McKinsey was amazing. It was an amazing training in a way. I got trained that I didn't get in grad school, in a way I didn't get in undergraduate school, right? And I learned a bit more about, again, the work ethic and influencing and managing meetings and, you know, how to lead. All things that I didn't get necessarily in school, and all things that I didn't get at the knee of an uncle or somebody else, because it's just a world that nobody's exposed to. So great times.
Yeah, because that with like the way I sometimes see like higher education, it's about sort of introducing you to the world and like picking up like sort of skills like leadership, and then basically getting that sort of deeper analytical mind comes at work. What would you say was one of the main key things you picked up at Harvard Business School?
At Harvard and at McKinsey, I think it's the importance of the numbers, particularly at Harvard, right? Harvard is all about, hey man, then, you know, every day you're getting a business case at Harvard.
Yeah.
And so it's not proper like whiteboard teaching you technique. It's let's look at a business situation. And let's analyze the problem. In the back of every case, they give you the financials for a company, and you look at the financials and you look at what was said in the interviews and piece these together. You say, this is what's going on. And so what you'd learn is this ability to extract data and then tell a story. Right. And what you find in corporate America, in the world, is your ability to drive change is your ability to extract information, to craft it into a story that people could quickly and easily digest and get on board with to move to action. Important in corporate America, important in politics, important in driving social change. That's what I've learned. One of the most important things. If you can't do that, whether you're working in advertising, you got to get an insight that taps into somebody's identity that drives them. They're like, yes, I'm going to buy that Porsche. Yeah. That's where I'm at. Or it's like, hey man, this is why universal healthcare is good for you. Like that is like the most critical thing. It's funny. I'm teaching my son that now, right? My son, he's 10 going on 11. And he's into stop motion videos. He's got all these Legos and all these action figures, and he follows these guys on YouTube who do the stop motion figures, stop motion videos. And what I see to him is like, okay, let's sit down and let's talk about the script. What is the story? What is the arc? Where are we going with this? And you have to really think about that and how it's going to hit people. how it's not going to be too much.
Yeah.
It's not going to be too little. And let's think about that. So again, so my experience, he'll benefit from. Again, that's a big theme in my life. It's like, how do we take knowledge and pass it on generationally?
Yeah, no. I think with regards to sort of generational thinking, I think that's something what needs to be definitely put into play, because what you kind of see happen, like in many sort of like communities, is there'll be a surge one and then it just drops away, and it's like all those lessons are forgotten. And with regards to sort of, I think that's partly down to, there is no such thing as a financial education in school. It's like, how do you balance a checkbook? What is, like, if you use credit cards, what's this? How can like loans be used to sort of acquire property or anything like this? I know it's something like some people are like, oh, okay, but it all kind of ties in to sort of like a bigger picture of, if you know this, you're going to know that, and you can know how it's going to affect this. So there's always a sort of connecting chain all the way through to help.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think there's also, if we step up from that, the question again becomes why? Like, how do we not pass down things generation? And one of the things I try to do is observe folks who succeed, or groups that succeed. And one of the things I've noticed is that, and you know, people may blast me for this, you know, as Black people, we're taught that you have to work twice as hard as the next man to get half as much, right? The reality is, working twice, it's almost impossible to work twice as hard as the next person to get half as much. It's almost impossible to be twice as smart as the next person, right? Because every group's got tons of folks. What I've found is we work hard as individuals. Like, if I'm struggling with calculus, I'll double down and triple down on the hours working by myself to improve my mastery. And what's been shown is other groups, particularly if I go to like the Chinese and other Asians, like Koreans and such, and Japanese, what they do is they study in groups. They're not afraid to show and to share learnings across each other, and they'll collaborate and they'll pool the knowledge and they'll advance the whole group. And I think there's probably an opportunity for us to do a little bit more of that in general.
Yeah, no, I agree. Because I was talking to a lady named Rebecca. Why can't I remember her last name? Rebecca yesterday for the podcast. Rebecca Robinson. She does financial advice for women. And like one of the things as like a late, like as a mother herself of two children, she went from like having her first child and kind of working. And then when her second child came along, then like there was like no income. Now she's like got the mindset of building a team. So there's can help her do X, Y, and Z so she can concentrate on this and have another part of a team to do like tackle that. And it's always like, you know what I mean, virtual assistants types things, but it's still the process, I believe, is still the same thing. Knowing how to build a team, maximize your efforts on many fronts rather than sort of being like killing yourself trying to run everything, which
and controlling things, right? Like you have two paths forward, right? Like take a pie, you can figure out how to eat more of the pie, right? Yeah. And you can stress yourself trying to control the eating of the pie. Yeah. Or you can figure out how to make the pie bigger to let more people eat.
Yeah.
I think, you know, some of our cultural traditions lead to sort of the more individualistic, but sort of like big man control everything and little, you know, you drop some crumbs down to the little, right? It's a very tribal, very, you know, traditional way of thinking versus, hey, I'm going to figure out how to deploy my resources, decentralize control, make the pie bigger, and also plan for succession, right? Teach the next generation. And I think that's a cultural learning that I've observed from being exposed to all these different cultures and say, okay, now I can bring this back to my community, to my people.
Yeah, like one thing with regards to economics and like communities. Like I was watching.
Didn't think this conversation was going to go this way in this interview, huh?
I don't, like, with regards to the conversation goes where it goes.
Where it goes,
like, I don't, this is even why I don't sort of don't go, this is what I, like, no, I just let it go. Now, as I was saying, with regards to community, I was watching a TED talk about, it was about black spending power. And, like, they were talking about how long, I think, like, I'm paraphrasing slightly, how long does like $20 stay in each community? And like they went, I believe they went Chinese community, like Asian community. They said it stays in the community for 30 days before that money goes out. And then it went with Jewish community, stays in that community for 20 days before it goes out. Like Caucasian, like I think it was around about the same amount of time and then it goes out. How long do you think it stays in the black community for?
Probably about 5 days.
Guess again.
Oh man, don't tell me it's in hours. Please don't tell me it's in hours. 2 days.
No, it stays in the black community for 5 to 6 hours and then it's gone.
Yes.
Like, and like this is the thing, like it ties in with like how you're talking about generational. Like because I think with regards to like regards to many a person out there who has been highly educated or has that sort of entrepreneurial spirit, I think more people need to be out there making businesses, companies, and basically learning the sort of capital side of it, like the real big side of it. Because don't get me wrong, yes, as I would always go, start up a business, start up a business, start up a business. But to do something grand, huge, knowing how to do like VC stuff, that's something which evades me. I when I went to university, I only did psychology and sociology. I wasn't into a whole business side of things. I haven't got an MBA, but I think more on that level rather than, you know what I mean?
Where is and what I always tell people, right, this is all, you know, there's a lot of self-directed learning you could do. It's great that I have this stamp of approval from the Harvard Business School, right? It opened the doors for me, right? But my learning doesn't stop there. And I said to other folks that your learning can be quite self-directed. I think the thing that I've taken away along this vein, right, is I'm well qualified to get a job in somebody else's corporation and make lots of money. And then, of course, I'm at their whim. They can release me at any time. Hey, Marcus, hold on 1 second. What's that? Goodyear one. My son asked me for the Wi-Fi password. So the thing that I've taken away is now I understand the importance of bringing world-class skills to basic services. Because to your point, how do you keep the money in the community?
Yeah.
You actually have to have a series of services that are well run so that people don't leave the community to get something they could get in the community. When I look, I start thinking about what my retirement looks like. Again, I get quite nationalistic, if you will, as it relates to Jamaica. And I start thinking about what does my life look like if I move back to Jamaica, right? Yeah. I could do the typical, you know, guy in America who's made a lot of money, buy a couple condos, and I could go back to Jamaica. But that doesn't really move Jamaica forward. Right. And it doesn't take advantage of my life skills that I've acquired in business. And I started saying, okay, if Jamaica was to advance as a country, where could my skills be of service? Right. And doing something basic. And I've started to explore food production. Like, how do we help Jamaican farms become more productive? And your point about, you know, understanding the capital side of business. So one of the things you find out when you look at Jamaican food production is the businesses are undercapitalized, right? And then you look at the root cause of why they're undercapitalized. It's because, and this is a problem in West Africa as well, a lot of folks don't have clear title, can't prove clear title. If you can't prove clear title, you can't borrow. If you can't borrow, you can't improve your capital you know, that you deploy, you know, your tractors and this and that, and you also can't get skilled yourself.
Yeah.
So I started looking at how can I bring that knowledge of navigating this system, creating entities that provide capital to upskill and upcapitalize the food production so that Jamaica becomes more self-sufficient. Like my fantasy is like, how can I turn Jamaica to Wakanda? Like, how do I take that warrior maroon spirit of independence to make them self-sufficient? Because they are very, I mean, we're a proud people, we're innovative and resourceful people, but the way the world capital system is thrust things upon us, there's some barriers we need to overcome. And so I think it would be remiss for me to not look back and see how I can use all this experience I gained here in America to, you know, do something to help our countries. Event.
Yeah, no, I hear you, I agree. And like, this is the thing, like, because I think like someone like yourself is definitely going to be sort of well placed in like helping with something like that. The reason why I say that is like when you were like your time at American Express, like it was kind of, how can I say, it definitely, like for me, when I look back sort of at the mid 90s to the early 2000s, like it was definitely a shift in the way everything was done. It was the start of it, and it, like, that sort of like trying to find the new sort of ways of doing things, what work, what don't work, everything with the rise of the internet. Because like, this is the thing, you tell your son, like, there was a time there was no internet. You could, like, you basically, to search for information, you either had to have encyclopedias in your house, go to the library, or you had to wait for a documentary, which would be televised whenever it's televised.
Right.
Good luck.
I could tell you. Yeah, I could tell you stories. So I was, during my time in American Express, I was there. So I was working, just to set the context, I was working in the corporate strategy team.
Yeah.
The corporate strategy team, it's like an internal McKinsey team of, you know, folks from consulting firms who were come in and work on big, big initiatives for the CEO to help transform the company. At the time, the CEO was Harvey Golub, very successful in launching and revitalizing American Express. But we're in that time where Ken Chenault, one of the first Black CEOs of a major Fortune, I think American Express was a Fortune 100 company at that time, was making the transition. It's a big thing. And so I was at the table in the middle of these conversations, one on the future of the American Express business, how we're going to transform it, what businesses we're going to sell off, where we're going to double down investments in it. Two, observing this power shift, this handing off of the ship from Harvey to Ken Chenault, and what Ken had to deal with, you know, as an African-American man, with all the publicity in the midst of a major lawsuit against Visa and MasterCard, and then internal politics, you know, what it took for him to handle, to navigate that, and then have an incredibly successful run as CEO. It's really amazing to be in the middle of that. And I learned a lot. What I learned is, fuck all difficult to do. Like, this man, like, I would watch him leave his office on a Friday. Like, he has a, you know, an office is downtown right across from the World Trade Center at the time. Yeah. And then he had his weekend house out in Hamptons, and they have a helicopter that would just fly him out there. And he would leave like with a duffel bag full of decks that he would be reading over the weekend just to keep up with the business. Like, a duffel bag, right? So you feel bad, like, yo, oh, man, oh my God, I gotta work. I gotta put in 8 hours on a Saturday on this initiative. Like, you know. And so I mentioned this story because it goes back to something I was saying earlier around what does it take for you to succeed, right? To have that trajectory. And one of the things that I learned in observing Ken, I sort of distill this down to three things. Like, one, you have to have the raw capability to perform. Mm-hmm. Two, you actually have the have the opportunities in front of you that are meaningful and important to deploy those skills again, so people can actually see.
Yeah.
Three, you have to have somebody who's willing to see that you've got these skills and advocate for you. And then four, you have to have somebody who's willing to pull you up. And then the fifth thing is, you actually have to have almost not, like, not an unfettered path, but you have to have a sequence of these opportunities that lead you up. Because you can have all those things, and if you don't have, if you, you know, and you move up the organization, if you end up in a dead end business or, you know, something that's intractable, all of a sudden your rise through the top fails. And then the sixth thing is, you got to be younger than the guy that the guys in front of you, right? Like, I watched, yes, it is incredibly difficult for Black men. Like, it's like, you know, having a camel walk through the eye of the needle, right? Difficult for a Black man to make this run. There was also a lot of qualified white guys who didn't make the CEO. Yeah. And they looked and they said, you know what? Ken's in front of us. Ken is younger than us. Mm. And so I got to think about where else can I go, because there's a finite number of seats at the top and I'm not going to get this one. So I got to go somewhere else.
Yeah, I would add one more to that. The ability to recover if you do stumble, because like, this is the thing. Like, success is sometimes seldomly linear, but if you like, when, as you say, you've got to have all of these things going for you, but like, there's going to be times where everyone stumbles and, like, you know what I mean, finds that hard road. And like, the times people I think really fail and can't recover is like when they lose that ability to, like, oh, I stumbled, I've fallen, let me get up. As the old saying goes, fall down seven, get up eight, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and what's interesting, I'm so glad you brought up that point, because it's a critical point, right? You need to have that resilience. Mm. But what's also helpful is if you could have somebody help you get up, right? Mm. And so, you know, in our Black and Brilliant subgroup, one of the things we talk about, again, is this advocacy piece, right? And navigating the internal politics. So there's a lot of times, your falling down is also a function of somebody kicking you down a little bit, right? You've run into some, you've lost some internal battle, somebody's pushed you out of the way or whatever, or you might've actually had a hiccup. I had something happen to me, and I'll be very public with this, right? Because I've actually never said this out loud to anybody. But now that I'm in this therapy session here with you.
Well, it's just me and you here, just me and you.
Yeah, me, you, and the listeners. But I remember I had wrote an email about an interaction with a colleague. And I said, you know, he was being very not responsive and, you know, just, you know, he's just blah. And I mentioned something like this, and I meant it to go to one person, and it went to more than one person.
Ooh.
And then it got back to this individual. Now, this individual wound up getting pushed out because his performance was, you know, I was spot on, like his performance wasn't. But somebody else saw that, and this woman crapped on me every time that she could, and it wound up being career limited for me.
Mm.
And no matter how well I performed, there weren't other Black people that would say, you know what, yeah, he had this hiccup, but let me expend some political capital to uplift him. What we found in our Black and Brilliant group in our conversations is, it's very easy for Black people to advocate, to say, oh yeah, you need to interview this person for a job, right? Because it really does, you don't really have to spend a whole lot of political capital. And it's harder, it gets harder to say, I might hire this person, or I strongly want you to hire them, because they themselves are in a sort of precarious organizational position. And then it becomes really difficult, like, this person has hit a bump in the road, let me go and help pull them up. That's a really tough thing. That we, because sometimes we feel, you know, our positions and company is somewhat tenuous, that we don't do as much. And we're trying to give people advice and counsel, make them aware of this so that more of that happens.
Mm. Yeah, no, like, just the thing. I say it, like, not like sort of like being in the sort of major corporate world game. Like, I do what I do, I get on with my life. But like, to go, yeah, like, it would be very easy for someone who doesn't have skin in that type of game to like go, oh yeah, you should really just be there for each other and like put, like, you know what I mean, put your neck out for that person. Look, I have to like go, there are some people you look at, you know they're your friends and stuff like this, and you like go, you are not what I call the brightest star in heaven. And me putting you out there is going to only hurt us both out. But like, if there is an exceptional talent, yeah, I'll say always look out for that, because when they shine, you'll shine, you know?
Yeah.
And I understand how you got to be careful with that. And I understand why some people wouldn't like go, yes, let me do that. And I think sometimes there is an emphasis amongst the black community. Like, why can't you get them a job here? You're like,
No, it's interesting, right? You know, Tony, I came to meet Tony Ethic from Black and Brilliant, where you saw that post.
Yeah.
I came to meet him years ago, right? Interviewed me for, recommended me for a job, or we were looking to work together. I wound up going somewhere else.
Mm.
But he is someone that has very actively used his position and his capital to advocate for black folks. To sort of lift people. And it's been, you know, not everyone has made it, but it's really, you know, it's heartening to see that. And we started talking about why does that not happen more? And it all happened, you know, it's your ability to do that is a function of how strong a performer you are, right? It goes back to, you know, doing twice as well to get, you know, hopefully now 3/4 as much, right? Not half as much. And so the question is, how do we find the real, real star performers at the senior levels that can advocate for, you know, up and coming talent, who can, you know, give a stamp of approval that's officially recognized? To say, you know what, if Maurice or if Tony or if this person puts a stamp of approval on that person, then by God, I can expend some political, social capital to help them move forward.
Yeah.
But it's dicey.
Yeah, no, I know it's dicey. Like there is a picture of my girlfriend's class when she went to Pembroke University in Cambridge. Basically, Cambridge and Oxford, you've got a number of different college campuses, and then you sign up to that, but you go to like the main sort of like school.
Right.
And as I look at the picture, there is like, it's mostly a white, like white group. There is a couple of black people, quite a few Indian people, like Asian people, but it's a case of you kind of look at it and go, right, like this sort of higher echelon, getting more people going through these schools. It, like the way I look at it, going through like schools like Harvard, Yale, Cambridge, Oxford, is helping putting you in to a group and like community of people who are going to end up being high achievers. And if we can get more people into these schools, into this sort of realm of influence, I think that would be, it would do a hell of a lot of good rather than not.
No, I think that's a huge, you're absolutely right. Yeah, absolutely right. And then the trick is then, how do we come back with, you know, it's like you said, these discoverers are across the world to go find new lands of wealth and opportunity. Right now, you've got to come back with, here's what I've learned in my journeys, and bring back the knowledge to your community, right? You know, so I look back to where I've come from, and I'm like, Jesus, like, how can I bring some of that back to, you know the projects and those folks, or, you know, Jamaican community, like whoever, like, how do I bring that back? So I think it's those two things, right? Because without a foundation, you're always in a perilous position, right? Like I can make a good living here in America, I have a house, but if things go sideways, right? Like Trump gets another 4 years, right? Like, what does that look like? Things can be taken away.
I
don't think that's going to happen.
I sit here, I look at it and go, because let me just say this, with regards to the Democrat Party, putting Biden forward. All I've got to simply say is it looks like they're not even trying to win. Look, if when you put like someone forward, like, look, when it was Bernie Sanders and Biden, like, as the two front runners. It was just like, I looked at Biden and went, are you sure you know what day of the week it is? Not like, you know what I mean? Because, like, you seem overwhelmed. And Bernie Sanders, like, the more I look at that guy coming through, he's a lot of talk and no real sort of action, if you get what I mean. It's like,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think, and this is one of the insights I've gotten into humans, and particularly in some of my work more recently, is that people are way more tribal than you think they are.
Yeah.
And, you know, and people play identity politics way more than you think they do. You know, in America, we're really great about saying, you know, saying to Black people, oh, you need to stop playing identity politics. White people play identity politics probably I have a lot more than Black people. And what you find is that what makes Trump popular and what makes Biden palatable is that he plays to an identity that makes people comfortable. What people reject about a Bernie Sanders is, at the end of the day, they don't really give as much care about policy as you might think, right? The other group might put into place Sanders policies, right? The right, and all of a sudden they're acceptable. But if the left puts those into place, they're bad, which tells you a whole lot about the tribal, emotional, cultural affinities versus folks actually understanding policies.
I think over in the States, over in the UK and everything like that, it's not even the policy what matters anymore. It's more the emotion, how it makes you feel purely and simply. Absolutely. If you've got the warm and if that person gives you the warm and fuzzies, they're gonna get in, and policy be like damned. You like go right. You want to do this policy to surveil everyone's internet, or you want to do this? No, but if you like go yeah, but you remember this time of old and this. How did that make you feel?
Yeah, made me feel really good. Yeah. And it's funny, right? Because a lot of the work that I've done recently and the work that I'll be doing going forward, basically it's marketing and advertising, right? Which is rooted in the social sciences of understanding people.
Yeah.
What feeds their emotional needs for becoming their aspirational self, right? All that Maslow stuff, right? And to your point, it's like, I always use this example. Audi A4, the BMW 3 Series, and a Mercedes C-Class basically all perform the same. But they basically speak to different tribes, right? If you're a BMW guy, you're all about being the alpha male. If you're the Mercedes guy, you're sort of like, I'm doing what mainstream people expect me to do as I succeed. And if you're the Audi guy, you're like, I'm cool standing apart from the world. I don't necessarily want to stand out and be flashy, but I'm very comfortable in my own skin standing up. And so when you recognize that people have these different needs and you can feed them the same thing, you realize how you can speak to people via emotion and via like tribal affinities to get them to buy your product, whether it's a car or political direction or, you know, supporting a social cause or whatever.
With regards to the sort of marketing world, back with the whole changing thing, but there are many a person who, like, you know, Gary Vaynerchuk?
Of course, yeah.
Like, there's his, like, sort of, like, mantra to sort of marketing and everything like that. Like, do TikTok, do, like, this, like, yeah. But, like, go with undervalued attention and go forward with that. Now, that is one way, but in this sort of modern corporate setting, what is that like now? Because is it leaning towards what he says, or is it sort of a little bit more complicated now?
I say it's a little bit more complicated. Look, you know, once upon a time, before we had what I call the democratization of communication, right? You know, 30 years ago, brands would blast TV ads at you.
Yeah.
And they didn't necessarily have to listen to you, right? Because there weren't many channels for them to listen to you through. Now you've got all these two-way social media platforms You've got these devices that are providing feedback. And humans now have a much greater ability to provide reviews and just tell the story of like, you know, let me tell you why you shouldn't fly United, right? Mm. Like, you know, if United lost your bag 30 years ago and they treated you like crap, you had no ability to blast them. Yeah. Today, you know, you break somebody, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen this video, United Breaks Guitars, where this guy was going, he's a musician, he's traveling, he sees through the window, the baggage handler is basically throwing his guitar around, blah, blah, blah. After they told him he couldn't carry the guitar on the plane, he checks the guitar and they just damage it. He's very rare guitar. So, right. So, and then they give him the standard like $1,000, blah, blah, blah. It's a rare guitar. He can't play the gig, all the stuff. And they just handle him like pushing him away.
Yeah.
He creates a musician, he creates this YouTube video. It goes viral, it's 25 million views. And he basically, through this effort, and then now, so once it starts going viral, they start trying to offer him more and more and more. And what shows you is the balance of power between the consumer and the brands has shifted. He took, you know, this one incident probably took about 10% off of the value of United for like a year and a half. And I don't think United's ever recovered because it's come to light that operationally they don't treat people well. So this is what I mean, that is this democratization and the balance of power being shifted a little bit more towards the consumer. So all that to come back to, how do I see marketing? I see marketing as now brands need to take cues and they need to listen to the consumers a lot more and figure out what do consumers like and how to become more of that, right? You actually have to think of the brand as a person or as a leader of a group. And you're like, okay, if I'm the leader of this tribe, where are the people that overlap with me that will have affinity to who I am? And how do I become more of that? How do I talk to them? How do I pull them in? How do I send out cues that we are one? And it used to be, you need to be with me. Now it's, let me tell you why we should be together. And I've listened to you and I've become more of that. Whether it's Ford saying, I want to be more tough. And I know that tough is important to you. We embody tough. Let's be tough together. We're only selling trucks. We're getting rid of cars in the US. And this is what we stand for versus like a company that's like more generic. Like, so I think brands are being forced to be more pure or more committed to something that resonates with the core customer.
Like a customer identity.
So maybe Gary probably talks a little bit about that, but he probably talks a little bit more about the tactics. I think there's a broader philosophical change, recognizing that what draws people is the emotional and the cultural identity, to your point earlier.
Yes. I think, definitely. Over the next, I'm going to say 12 to 18 months, when we come out of the lockdown world, I think this is going to be definitely something which is going to be more in play going forward.
Hugely in play, right? So I work with some thought leaders who are authoring pieces on what brands should do in this moment of COVID-19, in this moment of seeking greater justice, social justice, equity. And they're like, what do we do? Right? What's the advice that we give companies, right? Which is, you know, one, it's tough to be a company being tasked with like, I gotta solve America's social justice problems. Like,
yeah.
You shouldn't have that burden. Right. But number two is, you know, you have to figure out who you are at your core. And where do you have a right to have a conversation, right? So you're Ford, you probably don't have a whole lot of right to have conversations around police reform, but there might be things that you can do historically because of what your founder, what were important to your founders around education.
Yeah.
Right? And then you can talk about in that domain of getting equity, a brand can speak, can do. And I think brands are gonna start figuring out, okay, where are the domains where I have the right, where I'm relevant to have those conversations to drive change, to drive impact. So I see that. And that would, you know, that's what I would counsel people to do. That's what I would help them do. Mm-hmm.
So with regards to yourself, what do you find, like, what do you think your future is going to be like in the next, say, 3 to 5 years time?
Yeah, that's interesting, right? Now, you know, I know I look young. You can't see me in the podcast, right? But, you know, right now, you know, as Dr. Strange said, man, we're in the end game, right? So it's the race to, you know, to prepare for the retirement. But I think, in the next 3 to 5 years, so I'm in the midst of a career change. My company, Kantar Consulting, was bought by Bain Capital. And as some of you may be aware, like when private equity comes and buys your company, there's always a big turn. So I'm like literally 2 days away from making a decision on taking on a new role, either with a big tech company or with a big advertising agency. I'm wavering between these two. What will my future look like? That's a very tricky question. Because socially, I'm probably going to do a lot more writing.
Okay.
To talk about some of these, some of the things that we talked about, how to move brands and how to move individuals forward. Mm. If I end up at the advertising agency, it's a very different trajectory because I'll actually be helping one particularly, like one of the 5 largest brands in the U.S. Articulate who it is and what it wants to be and how it's positioned for the future in this world of 5G and all this stuff. So it's a telecoms company.
Say 5G.
Very different.
Don't say 5G.
No. Hey, you know, public service announcement, 5G does not cause COVID. So it's just dead that right now.
For the devil as well.
Yeah. There's all that, right? Yeah. People got COVID in Ecuador right now, really bad. And it has nothing to do with 5G. but that being said, so, you know, I might be working with a brand to help, you know, them articulate, think about being better, smarter, connecting with their consumers, and just doing more of that work whilst on the side mentoring and thinking about how technology can move my community forward. If I end up in one of these tech platform companies, that's a great question. You know, I might be doing more work on the inside to help get more folks like me on the inside, you know, once I cement myself.
Yeah.
So it's hard to say, right? But there's definitely, you know, how do you balance the internal and external? I always tell people, and I advise this to folks, particularly folks getting out of, you know, university route to really start their career, their main career in earnest. Look, everybody has a recommended daily allowance of satisfaction you need in your life, right? And you can get it from one of 3 places and you need to balance it out. You know, you need to sort out how you're going to balance it out, right? You get it from your social community, right? You know, the hobbies, passions, your crew, right? You get it from your family and you can get it from your professional career, right? Mm-hmm. So there are lots of people who get, you know, a disproportion from their professional career.
Yeah.
And a lot of people get a disproportion from the family. And some you get a disproportion from the social. I think for me, as I think about what's next for me, is just making sure I continue to expand my consumption of satisfaction, that I do it in a very balanced way, in a very purposeful way. I think early in my career, probably not enough on family. Probably, interestingly enough, probably too much on social, probably too much on work. It'll probably still, you know, I've come to grips with, I'm very excited that I can get more from work by where I choose to. You have more power. And quite frankly, if you choose a career where you're not getting that satisfaction, you won't thrive. So it's really important to make sure that you enjoy the work. Because work is hard enough as it is. Mm. So, you know, I've really learned that late in life. Like, look, man, do work that's interesting to you. Work with people that are good to you, that are good to be around. Because to really shine, to really develop expertise, you need that support environment. And then, you know, the family piece is huge, right? It's why we're here. So I want to make sure that balance stays true.
Outstanding. Excuse me. So I've got to say, I do like what you're saying. Like, yeah, there's some really important points there. If you can, in the future, with regards to your writing or some other medium, to get some of that marketing information out there to sort of like up and coming businesses in like mm-hmm. Black community, or in like to youngsters who are looking to help like start something new. I think that'd be really powerful going yeah. forward. I think really sort of most really quite gratifying. But yeah,
God deserves. I want to encourage people. Well, look, we got a lot of people going chasing jobs in big corporations. You know, I'm not saying don't do that. What I'm saying is do it purposefully, because there's a bunch of and I think people underestimate the skills that you can get in that environment that you can bring back to smaller businesses in your community that you can use to build capital, right? Because as long as you're working for somebody else, I mean, unless you're a star. Like, I have a friend I went to high school with. He's a CEO of a major division of a major telecom company.
Yeah.
And he's done a fantastic job of, in the corporate world, accumulating wealth. But that's a rare person. You know, most people have a solid career, you get a few stock options, and then in your 40s, and you're like, okay, how am I going to accumulate wealth? And there may be an opportunity for some of those folks to get off that path, take the bit of capital that they have, and to start something that is germane, relevant, important to the community, whether it's a educational tutoring service, whether it's repair shop, like something. But I think we need to give thought to opportunistically doing a little bit more of that. And I think, you know, at least in America, there's always been challenges. Like, we don't. The sad reality is a lot of times you have skills that lead you to think that opportunity is beneath you because we're playing catch up. Like, if we had more capital, we would do bigger things. But the fact of the matter is we need to play catch up. And some of that playing catch up is having really smart people doing jobs that are probably, or starting businesses that on the surface, they're overqualified. But you got to fill that niche and you got to build it so that generationally, the next generation will then have capital. The problem with us from the African diaspora is we're undercapitalized wherever we are. And so the game has got to be accumulating capital so that we can control our destiny a little bit more.
Absolutely.
I didn't mean to end with the deep thing, but.
Yeah, you know what? On that point, I'm going to end it there. But yeah. But can you tell people how they can find you?
How can you find me? Well, you know, you can find me on LinkedIn. Yeah. That's probably the easiest, more efficient way to find me. And it'll probably be a slap in the face, a wake-up call for me. I need to publish more things on LinkedIn so you can see a bit more of my writings and stuff. So this has been great for me as well. So I don't want you to think this has been a one-way street. It's been quite cathartic. So thank you for inviting me on. I really appreciate that. I look forward to staying in touch with you as well.
Oh, absolutely. Damn right. I've got to say, yeah, pleasure having you on today, sir. You've been outstanding. Lots of food for thought. Definitely will have you back on in the future because I feel like I've only scratched the surface of something quite rich and special.
Thank you for that. Yeah, and maybe next time I'm in the UK, if not banned Americans from coming this year, we'll link.
Oh, you know what? I think they're just gonna lock the door. Well, we'll quarantine you for 14 days, let you back out.
Yeah,
Absolutely. I will take you out.
It's interesting
too, for sure.
Yeah, me too. Right, for sure. It's interesting how you can create virtual walls. Right, Trump has created a virtual wall around us. It's quite clever.
He's got what he wanted. There you go.
Yeah.
Excellent. Let me just say, Maurice, thank you very much for coming on today. I would like to say thank you to all my friends and life warriors out there. Have a great day. Have a fantastic weekend. Well, whenever this comes out. And all I got to say is be cool, be excellent, be fantastic. Be all the positive bees you can be in this world. I hope that's good for you. Peace. Yeah.
Peace, brother. All right. Blessings.